Welcome to Behind the Story, a program where we take you straight to the source. In this episode, we'll revisit some conversations from earlier in the year. First up is KWBU's talk with Dina Davidson. Davidson is the Director of Research at the Center of Excellence for Research on Returning War Veterans here in Waco. Davidson's latest study aims to find a potential treatment for Gulf War illness. At least one in four of the roughly 700,000 soldiers that served in the Gulf War suffer from the illness. Symptoms are wide-ranging and remain largely unexplained. Veterans who suffer from the disease often experience fatigue, headaches, and problems remembering things, just to name a few. There have been few effective treatments, but Davidson's research hopes to change that.
Dina, when we're talking about Gulf War illness, what exactly does that entail?
Gulf War illness is a multi-syndrome disorder that affects six domains depending on what kind of classification system you're using. Mm-hmm. The Kansas case assessment for Gulf War illness is what's one of the predominant ways of assessing Gulf War illness, and it would look at things like there's problems with fatigue, sleep difficulties. These veterans are often very tired because they're not sleeping well. There's widespread pain, such as muscular skeletal pain and nerve pain. There are neurological problems. They have chronic headache and a lot of difficulty concentrating and thinking, some memory loss. Skin rashes are very common. GI issues such as constant diarrhea or stomach cramps. Mm. So it's a very, very debilitating disorder.
As you've just said, GWI presents itself through multiple and diverse symptoms, and it can even take a while before it's apparent that someone suffers from it. All that has led many to call it a perplexing sickness. So with all that in mind, how do you even go about trying to find something to treat it?
That's a very good question, and you're right. It does present in many different ways. The differences in the symptoms that people will have, usually for it to be diagnosed as Gulf War illness, you have to have three out of the six categories that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. But the fact that there can differ amongst the same veterans who were in the Gulf War during the time that all this was happening has to do with what their toxic exposures were. Some were closer to the munitions demolition sites. Some were closer to when the oil wells were burning, and so they were exposed to toxic stimulants coming from the oil wells. Some, it's more associated with the vaccines that they had or the exposure to pesticides. And so that's why you can see different sets of symptoms in different people. But that, of course, makes it difficult to know how to treat. And right now, the research is getting to looking at potential medications that can help. And there's a lot of research trying to find some biological markers that would definitively say that these people have Gulf War illness and help distinguish them.
The research you and your team will be conducting is going to identify biomarkers to help find an appropriate treatment for GWI. Can you explain what a biomarker is and how studying that might help you?
Right. Well, this study that I'm doing right now is not so much going to identify a specific biomarker to identify Gulf War illness. But what we do hope it does is perhaps identify subtypes or people who are most helped by the medications that we're going to be administrating. So the two medications that we'll be giving in this trial have been shown to be effective in fibromyalgia. And many Gulf War illness patients have symptoms very similar to fibromyalgia, if not fibromyalgia on top of their symptoms. Since they are three medications known to be helpful for treating fibromyalgia that are FDA approved, it makes sense, given the similarities between the symptoms, to try and find out if it helps Gulf War veterans. And again, if it does, then we would want to see who does it help and who does it not help, and can they be differentiated by the interaction and the interplay with their genetics makeup.
Now, in 2006, the Department of Defense initiated the Gulf War Illness Research Program. What have we learned since then, and what remains a mystery around GWI?
I think the evidence is very, very clear now that there's a clear association between exposure to toxins and the symptoms. So initially, when people began complaining about these illnesses, because there wasn't any medical illness out there that would explain what people were experiencing, it was thought to maybe be psychological or psychiatric or somehow a mental health issue. So initially, some of the research went in that direction. We now know for sure that there's absolutely no psychological or psychiatric component. It's definitely a medical phenomena. We now know that there's at least six domains that it affects, and we know that the acetylcholine system is highly affected by the toxins that people experienced. So that is one of the neurotransmitter systems that we're researching to find out how we could help help people recover from the symptoms. In addition, because it has now been characterized, which makes it easier for research study, more and more we're able to begin to look at medications that may be out there to try and treat some of the symptoms. It's difficult to do when at first you get a group of people coming and they all seem to have very different symptoms. But if you can actually categorize them into to fit into one diagnosis, that certainly helps with research.
So that's definitely the largest challenge around GWI as far as even from diagnosis to potential treatment.
Absolutely. And the same challenges were for fibromyalgia, for chronic fatigue syndrome. A lot of these very different diseases and disorders are very difficult to classify, and they take research to narrow it down.
And, you know, in the outline you sent me, there's a brief, like a table right at the front, and, you know, it takes a look at three different federally sponsored clinical trials to treat GWI, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's an antibiotic treatment, an exercise regimen of sorts, and something called a nasal continuous positive airway pressure. And
right.
it looks at all the varying results for those. But can you explain those treatment methods a little bit? And I mean, and how they might help?
I don't know enough about some of those other studies. I do know the airway one seemed to be helping, and that is because of the fatigue and the sleep issues that a lot of Gulf War veterans have. So my assumption would be that if you're helping with the airflow, if you're helping people breathe better during sleeping, so perhaps they're not waking up with sleep apnea, that would certainly help somewhat. That would help with fatigue. It wouldn't necessarily help with any of the other symptoms.
You know, reading through the little outline, the research outline, it says, you know, in the last 4 years, there have been three FMS treatment drugs that have been approved by the FDA. You know, how much of our understanding now or how much of this research involves how those treatments work?
I think a lot. One of the collaborators on this research project is an expert on fibromyalgia. His name is John Russell from San Antonio. And what's fibromyalgia, the main presenting symptom and the way it's diagnosed is through a tender point exam. So there's 9 tender points that a physician will touch on the arm and the legs and the neck that are very sensitive to touch, more so than it should be. And fibromyalgia is a syndrome where there's a lot of pain and pain to touch, which is similar to some of the symptoms of Gulf War illness. And so the two medications that we're testing that are efficacious when treating fibromyalgia, one of them is duloxetine, which is thought to affect mood and to have some mild analgesic effects. So we're going to test that by having people take it in the morning. The other medication that is helpful with fibromyalgia is pregabalin. And that is thought, it's a anticonvulsant, but the other effects are on neuropathy. Neuropathy are like the pain and nerve endings that you would get for diabetics. And again, many Gulf War veterans have those kinds of symptoms. It's also sedating. So we want them to take that medication at night. It will help them fall asleep and help restore some of their rest. Because even if you can get them to sleep a lot, their sleep isn't restorative. They still wake up very fatigued. And we're hoping with the these two medications right now, we're testing them separately. But if they both show promise, then one would hope that we could give them together or test them together against placebo. I also know that some physicians in VA are using these off-label because there is no treatment known for Gulf War illness, but there's already some evidence that it should work. It just hasn't been tested in a randomized controlled trial, and so that's what we're trying to do.
So you're trying to get that, I guess, proof that yes. that 100%.
Exactly, because it's great that there's case reports that maybe somebody gets better on a drug, but you never know what the reason is. It could be that just having the attention of the physician helps, and so somebody feels better. Until you compare it to a control, placebo control, you really can't be sure how it's working.
And so have the, I guess, advances in these other treatments, is that what's kind of spurred this research point right now, or what's brought you to this point?
Talking to a lot of other Gulf War researchers who had been at this a lot longer than I am, I'm relatively new to the field since I joined VA. I was an alcohol researcher, but Lee Steele, a former investigator from Baylor University, a professor, I think she's now moved down to Houston. She was aware of these two medications. She introduced me to John Russell, and together we began to work on this protocol, hoping to get it funded. And fortunately, we were successful at getting it funded at VA, and that's how it all started. She and her experience with other Gulf War investigators really felt that this was the way to go. And at the time it was funded, in 2013, I think I was first funded, it was one of the first medication trials in VA and also for Gulf War illness. There are more now, but not that many more yet.
Dr. Davidson, thank you for talking with KWBU today.
You're very welcome.
You can find out how to participate in Davidson's research or find out more about the study itself on our website at kwbu.org. And now, we'll listen to a conversation with Abigail Disney, director of the 2015 documentary, The Armor of Light. The documentary looks at the intersection of gun culture and conservative Christianity. Earlier last month, the documentary aired on PBS. Abigail, thanks for talking with KWBU today. The Armor of Light explores the relationship between American gun culture and conservative Christianity. And I'm wondering, for you, what's the moment when you realized these two cultures crossed?
Well, it kind of came to me in a bit of an epiphany, you know, when I was, you know, I would watch these laws get passed, and they would feel like they were just, at the end of the day, just expanding the ways in which you could deploy a weapon in public, you know, and when they took the duty to retreat out of self-defense law, that just struck me as just a Rubicon we should not be crossing. It's a way of saying that a death is not the worst outcome in this confrontation. And that, I don't know when this country switched into that country. And so it did strike me that we needed to take something of a fresh moral and spiritual look at it. And the people who speak the most moral and spiritual discourse in public in our country are evangelical Christians, and yet they're also, you know, incredibly supportive of this agenda. So especially in the way they talk about the sanctity of every single human life when they talk about abortion. So that just seemed like an incredibly fruitful place to go and to just sort of explore how this works in an evangelical's life.
The film, in part, follows an evangelical minister, Rob Schenck, and early on in the documentary, he's at somewhat of a moral crossroads, trying to come to terms with what he says is a moral failing of his community. Did he receive any backlash or become the center of attacks for taking this view?
It's not a popular view. And yeah, there's been backlash. The film's been out. We opened originally at Tribeca last year, so it's been exactly a year. But I will tell you, we were buckling in for a terrible backlash, and it hasn't been nearly as bad as we thought it would be, because there are people who have said to us things like, "You're speaking my secret language," or "Thank God someone is finally saying this." In some of the most conservative communities in the country, they're saying that to us. So I and Rob both have been incredibly pleasantly surprised by how much traction the film is getting, and you know, and how little blowback there's been.
And was Rob hesitant at all to talk to you because of this unfavorable opinion he has?
Well, you asked that question, and I kind of chuckle a little to myself because, yes, very hesitant. And I was constantly kidding and, you know, trying to get him to be a little more brave. But thankfully, he didn't listen to me. He was very cautious and very conscious about the steps that he took, in part because he's a very relational person. He loves the people he's among. They're his friends and his family, and he doesn't want to alienate them. But also because, you know, it's important to get this right. And, you know, he doesn't want to go sort of flailing forward into the unknown without a real sense of the unintended consequences, maybe, and the ripple effect of what he does. So there was hesitation at the beginning, and I now see it as he was really actually being incredibly thoughtful and cautious. And right now, I think all his hesitation is just gone. He's gotten more certain every day since the film came out.
Now, the other person the film follows is Lucy McBath, the mother of Jordan Davis, an unarmed teen who was shot and killed in Florida in 2012. Can you talk about her story and how it serves as somewhat of a counter to the other narratives we hear in the film?
Yeah. Well, Lucy McBath, obviously, her story is of a person who's actually had more than an abstract relationship with what a gun does. And so obviously she's the only person in the film who's speaking for people who, you know, really, really had a gun tear their life apart. And all the rest of everybody is really speaking in the abstract. And it's a little bloodless, right? It's a little lacking in passion. And so when Lucy speaks, she speaks from the depths of her pain. You know, one of the things about her is that's really powerful is when she cries, she never wipes her tears away. And I don't know if it's a conscious decision that she makes, but they lie there on her face, and they are, they're like calling out to you, you know, because the enormity of what she has suffered, you know, you just cannot overestimate it. So, you know, in many cases, you would consider the Lucy McBath story, and I don't mean to sound dismissive here, but most gun films are basically the story of a person who's lost somebody, and the filmmaker says, I want you to feel this pain so that you'll change your mind about these things. And that's to imply that people who carry guns don't care about her pain, and that's why that's never a very persuasive argument to people. That's not what we were saying at all. What Lucy does now is totally informed by her faith. And the more time we spent with her, the more we realized she was speaking exactly the same language Rob was speaking, and that they would make an incredible alliance if they ever met. And that's exactly how it turned out. I mean, Lucy took Rob from teetering, you know, in indecisiveness to really boldly moving forward.
Now, you're screening the movie in Waco, a historically conservative and religious area. How do you think the film will come across, considering its message?
Well, you know, the gun argument, such as it is, you know, is sort of characterized by a lot of yelling on both sides. And I think that's because both sides have their trolls. But the trolls don't really take up much of the continuum from one side to the other. Most of us are somewhere in between where the trolls lie. So the trick is when you show it in a place that's, you know, heavily concentrated with people who have an alternate point of view is to kind of define the trolls out of the conversation and let everyone else speak. Because everyone else is really speaking the heart and the voice of the community. So we try our best in these conversations to kind of lift up, for instance, the women's voice, because it's very rare that women in these communities speak up about it. And, you know, my experience is in even the most conservative places, the women are with us. And young people, they also tend to lean in our direction as well. So, you know, I'm convicted. I have a confidence in the power of this ethical and moral argument So we left the film as an invitation to a conversation and a very, very open, you know, it doesn't determine what you're supposed to think when you come out of it. And we did that deliberately because we know that the right thing speaks for itself. And that's what, in some of the most conservative places in the country, that's basically where we've landed in almost every place. So I hope people will come out to the screening because it's, you know, it's been a really powerful experience to talk with people afterwards.
And lastly, Abigail, it's my understanding that for some showings, for some of the showings at theaters, you've offered free admission to NRA members. How did that exactly work and what was that response like, if any?
Well, sadly, I wasn't in any of the theaters that the NRA members took us up on that offer, so I wasn't able to really interact with them. Although we have had NRA members at other screenings, and there are those who are really, really defensive, right? And the minute you just say, "Can we just talk?" they're swinging. And those, again, those are the trolls. But we know that the NRA is populated by more than just trolls. There are good, decent people who are members and have been members all of their lives who are happy to talk about it, you know, in good faith. And so you'd be very surprised by the people who have, you know, said to us, you know, "You've changed my heart on this subject. I want to think about this more." So, we loved inviting the NRA members. I would love for them to show up, you know, Monday night. That would be really great because I love hearing from them, you know, because it's more complex than everybody makes it seem.
Abigail, thanks for talking with KWBU today.
Thanks so much.
Abigail Disney is the director of the documentary The Armor of Light, which explores the relationship between American gun culture and conservative Christianity. And for our final conversation, we'll set our eyes and taste buds towards summer as we talk with Dustin Patterson of Heritage Creamery. Since early 2015, Heritage Creamery has sold its homemade, locally sourced ice cream at the downtown Waco Farmers Market, but it recently opened a brick-and-mortar location. KWBU recently visited the shop to see just how that ice cream is made. Nestled in the corner of the newly renovated building Heritage Creamery now calls home is its kitchen. It's a quaint operating space that's shared with Milo Biscuit Company. And on the day I visit, the sounds of pots and pans fill the air as General Manager Dustin Patterson and a crew of kitchen staff are preparing to make brown butter pecan. But this isn't your elementary school ice cream made with plastic bags, ice, and rock salt that they're making. Each batch of ice cream here is made with locally sourced ingredients. Patterson explains that decision this way.
We could have done it the way where you buy a pre-made base off of a truck that mass distributes that kind of stuff and buy flavorings to add to it, and we could have churned ice cream in-house even, and that would have been cool, but we make everything from scratch because we wanted to do it the best way we could possibly do it, and this is the best way to possibly do it. And it's much more difficult, but it's totally worth it.
And in that homemade process, there are three distinct stages. First, making a base for your ice cream. That's where you bring together all your dairy and flavoring.
This is butter.
It's butter.
Yeah, for the brown butter pecan.
That's Sam Davidson. He's worked with Heritage Creamery for about a year now.
So to bring out the really nutty, rich taste of the brown butter, of the butter, we obviously brown it, and that basically boils off the water in the butter, brings out a lot of the fats and proteins into kind of a nutty flavor, adds a complexity to the flavor that goes really well, obviously, with the pecans that we put in it.
In a separate pot, the dairy products and eggs are heated up. This pasteurizes the base, killing any bacteria that may be present, but heating it up also allows for the hot brown butter to blend into the dairy easier. After the base is prepared, it's then strained.
So we strain the base, can't get any, there's always gonna be a little bit of egg that cooks in there, a little bit of milk that curdles on the bottom. This will strain out any cooked egg, strain out any herbs we've been using, you'll see the vanilla.
Now the base is placed in an ice bath in the walk-in to cool for several hours. This step, Davidson explains, allows for the proteins and sugars in the base to mature and makes for a creamier texture.
Second stage would be churning. So it goes in the machine, the batch freezer that whips it up, churns it, makes it airy, light, and partially freezes it. It comes out kind of like soft serve.
For this particular batch, the now chilled base is poured into a batch freezer and churned at a steady 165 rotations per minute. Now, depending on the density of the ice cream, which, again, depends on the type of ice cream you're making, this step could take anywhere from 8 to 15 minutes.
All right, timer's up. Yeah, I think we're ready.
From here, the ice cream enters its final stage. It needs to be placed in a hardening cabinet, which is essentially a freezer that can drop the ice cream's temperature down to about negative 20 to negative 25 degrees. The crew here affectionately refers to their hardening cabinet as the James Hardening Cabinet. For those basketball fans, I hope you enjoy the pun. The idea of this step, Patterson says, is to freeze the product, to make it firm in short a period as possible, so that water molecules don't join together into larger ice crystals. You want to highlight the cream part of ice cream, not so much the ice. Patterson explains the next part of this step.
Once it's there, it's too hard to serve at this point, so we move it over to our holding cabinet to get it up to serving temperature for the next day. So it really is at least like a three-day process.
That's 3 days, three steps, 65 eggs for each batch of ice cream, or roughly 3,500 eggs each week, with each batch yielding about 6.5 to 7 gallons of ice cream. But all this considered, Davidson, who leads most of the ice cream making here, says it's a much simpler process than he thought. For KWBU, I'm Carlos Morales. You can hear this episode and past episodes of Behind the Story on our website at kwbu.org.